This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As the year winds down and we start to look ahead to 2017, it's time to step back and take a look at the big picture. I mean, really big, like given enough time one day, the constellation we know as the Big Dipper might look more like a big spatula. Or if you want something else to make your mind twist a little, what might a day look like in a star system with six or seven suns? Think about that. Those are just a few of the ideas offered up by my next guest, no stranger to this program, Dean Regas, outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, co-host of the PBS program Stargazers, and author of a really cool new book, Facts from Space, recently out from Adams Media. Welcome back, Dean.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ira.
We're on tap to eventually have a big spatula constellation.
Oh, yeah.
What's going to happen there?
That's kind of one of those funny things is that, the stars are moving relative to our position here. And so, over thousands and thousands of years, the constellations we see today will actually change a little bit. But we're talking big amounts of time, 75,000 years for us to notice some big difference. So our ancient, our distant ancestors will be able to look up at the stars where we saw the Big Dipper. They'll see something that looks like a big spatula, and who knows what kind of mythology will spring from that.
Yeah, because when we look at the Big Dipper, at the stars, we think they're all together. They all look like they're together in the sky, but they're really spaced far apart, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. They're quite different distances. And so when we look at that, when we look at Orion, all of the stars in Orion are different distances from us. So we actually can tell their distances and see what they would look like from different perspectives. So if we went around on the side, Orion wouldn't look like Orion at all. And it's just from where we are, we're positioned in space, that's what we see.
You've got a ton of great facts in this book, and the subtitle is Extraterrestrial Facts to Blow Your Mind.
Yes.
How did you collect them all over the years? Did you actually take notes every time something popped up?
Well, so I've been teaching astronomy for a long time, for about 18, 19 years. And so I do these programs about, I try to popularize the subject. I talk about Mars, I talk about the moon, and I give facts, and I can actually see what audiences react to, that they really like certain ones. And so I've taken some mental notes over the years, and then this book came about. I put them down on paper and ended up with 500 facts pretty quickly, and then the publisher said, well, that's a good start. We need 1,000. So then I had to get 500 more of the greatest hits that I could find.
You have a rundown of smuggled items on board rockets.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we think of the astronauts as these heroic people that they did these great things and risked their lives, and that's all true. But man, they could have some fun too. And so some of the astronauts smuggled a sandwich on board, which they just started, they started eating, while they're talking to NASA, and they said, put that sandwich away. On a Russian mission, that the wife of one of the astronauts smuggled a box of chocolates on board. They open up the box of chocolates when they're up in space. Chocolates fly everywhere in the weightlessness of space. And the report said it took them 2 hours to collect them. I think eat them more likely would be the right answer.
And you make a special project out of taking a tour of the solar system. Let's go through a few of those special places, like Mercury.
Oh, yeah. So Mercury, the big surprise, I mean, this is the planet closest to the sun, number one. Its surface temperature is 600, 700, 800 degrees. And we find actually there's water ice on Mercury in the North Pole, which is, man, that was a surprise when we found that. And then if you're on Mercury in certain places, you could watch the sun rise, and then it'll stop, turn around, go backwards and set where it rose, and then rise again. It's based on Mercury's very slow day and its very fast year. It's just a weird thing to see a sunrise, sunset, and sunrise right in the same place.
And Venus, there are three ways to die on Venus real quick?
Yeah, this is probably the worst planet for humans. I mean, we don't want to go there. What we found from our robotic spacecrafts was, number one, there's the heat. Venus is 900 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface, like everywhere. North Pole, South Pole, equator, daytime, nighttime, it's 900 degrees. Why it's so hot is because there's these clouds, this dense atmosphere that traps in the heat, and that atmosphere would actually exert such force on you, it'd squish you flat. The air pressure on Venus would squish you like a tin can. And then the third part where you could die is if the clouds open up and it starts raining. It doesn't rain H2O, it rains sulfuric acid. So you would be a melted, squished, acidy pile of goop on Venus.
You know, you spent some time with Pluto. Do you take any political position about?
Oh boy, here comes the controversial part. yes, I do. I do take a very strong position on Pluto. I am a Pluto is not a planet, and I'm very definitive about that. This is something that, boy, I had to come to this a hard way because I was always a Pluto defender. When I grew up, Pluto was a planet. I loved Pluto as my favorite planet because it was so weird and odd and small and. Well, then we found out in the 90s and 2000s that it's not alone out there. And we found now over 1,000 objects out where Pluto lives. And so that these other objects resemble Pluto a lot more than Pluto resembles, let's say, Neptune. I still was thinking, okay, Pluto should still be a planet. But then I have to think, well, what are you going to do with the other 1,000 things? You're going to call those planets too? And I thought, you know, I'm an educator, so how am I going to teach the kindergartners the 1,008 planets? This is going to be tough. but there's actually a precedent for this, that yeah. Planets have been kicked out of the Planet Club. Asteroids used to be planets, and they got kicked out. So I got the historic perspective, and then talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson and Mike Brown, the discoverer of other objects out there, they talked me into it. So I'm now a Pluto is not a planet person.
So the New Horizon discoveries with making Pluto come to life with all the magnificent photos,
yeah.
That doesn't change your mind about how could this
not
be
change
a planet?
My mind. I call it a unbelievably magnificent world, that's for sure. Not a planet, but a magnificent world. And there's so many of these out there. There's Eris that we need to discover, we need to explore. There's Sedna, there's Maki Maki, Haumea. And then there's all these moons that are out there too, the moons of Jupiter, the moons of Saturn that are worlds of their own too. So I put Pluto in the category of a mm-hmm. unbelievably cool world. I'm so glad we went to see it. And we sent the spacecraft out the year before Pluto got demoted, which, whew, good timing. It got out while Pluto was a planet.
Let's talk about the future. Now, I know, because I'm planning to see this one. There's a really major total solar eclipse coming up in 2017, isn't there?
Oh, this is good. I'm calling it the big one. We've been waiting for a total solar eclipse in the U.S. for a long time, and this is going to be on August 21st, 2017. Definitely mark your calendars, because on that day, the sun will be covered over by the moon completely. Covered over for a few minutes, and it is the most amazing sight you will ever see. I've seen a lot of astronomical events, but a total solar eclipse is like nothing you can ever see. And it's going to be visible from Oregon out to South Carolina on this little strip of about a 100-mile wide strip of land. So you have to be in the right place at the right time to see it. And if you live close by, drive to that spot because it should be magnificent.
Of course, you want to try to find a spot where it may not be cloudy. The chances of cloudiness are lower than other places, right?
Exactly. So there's a few hot spots that astronomers are looking at. I mean, number one, the place where there'd be the least likelihood of clouds would be in Wyoming. And so there's a lot of folks that are going out to Cody, Wyoming, and that environs out there. And then the place where you can get the maximum amount of eclipse, where you can see the maximum amount of time that the sun's blocked out, that's going to be in a strip between Illinois and Kentucky. And so a lot of people are going to those two regions. For me, I'm kind of not sticking on one place. I'm going to go wherever it's clear. So I'm going to be mobile. I'll be in my car with my telescopes and my cameras and my eclipse glasses and hitting the road and going wherever it takes me. So I could be anywhere between Kentucky and Wyoming. That's my plan.
Do you think there's going to be a stampede of people that maybe you make your reservations now in advance to...
Well, we've heard from the people wanting to go to Kentucky and view it from there, and I have heard that the hotel prices are, most of them are sold out. All the hotels are sold out, but ones that have availability are $899 a night. Minimum stay of 3 nights. if you haven't booked your hotel yet, I recommend getting your tent and you know, just camp out.
I think the correct word for that would be astronomical.
Oh, my gosh. Discussion. Yeah, I mean, you go to a Days Inn and it's $899 a night. That's, and
yeah,
people,
but you
are
don't
paying
have to,
it.
Well, all you have to do is being in a parking lot, though, right? You don't have to be in a hotel. It's going to last a few moments. And you happen to just be driving, you could pull off the side of the road.
Exactly. That's what's going to be interesting is what's this going to look like on the highways and interstates as this happens and goes across I-80 or something like that. But all you have to do is just stop and look. And this is, you know, I can hear Grandma Regas talking to me and say, Dean, don't look at the sun. Don't look at the sun. But this is the one time you can actually look at the sun when it's totally blocked out by the moon. And it is just incredible. I mean, it's one of those moments that even just thinking about when I saw the last one, or when I saw one in 10 years ago, it's just giving me chills thinking about it. It is really an awesome sight. So have you decided where you're going?
Yeah, I'm going to go out. I'll be out in Wyoming. So
Wyoming. All right.
Yeah,
great.
I'm giving a talk at a lecture of a bunch of astronomers out in Wyoming here.
Excellent. So, That's great. Well,
yeah, so my whole family, I'm getting the whole family out to come with me. My daughter was crazy about seeing this 3 years ago. She said, Dad, we got to go. I said, okay, now we're going.
That's awesome. Yeah, it should be real good for, you know, get families involved and friends involved. And this is something you shouldn't miss because, you know, in Cincinnati, we're going to be 90% blocked, 90% eclipse. And people are saying, well, we'll just stay in Cincinnati and watch the 90%. I said, no. 90% is like 10% of the experience. You got to see the total thing. So the big event is the August 21st.
All right. Don't tell anybody. We need some hotel rooms still available.
Oh, right. Yeah, you haven't booked your hotel yet. Okay. Yeah, don't go to Wyoming, people. go to Kentucky. There's still plenty of space.
Not to mention the rental cars. We won't mention that. Dean Regas is outreach astronomer at the Cincinnati Observatory, co-host of the PBS program Stargazers, and author of the new book, Facts from Space. It's really a fun book. It's subtitled From Super Secret Spacecraft to Volcanoes in Outer Space, Extraterrestrial Facts to Blow Your Mind. Dean, thanks again.
Oh, my pleasure. And keep looking up, Ira.
Happy holidays. Coming up, we're going to talk movie science, including a new Disney animation you'll get swept up in. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. If you're looking for something to do with the kids over the holidays, you should check out Disney's newest animated film, Moana. It's the story of a young girl who leaves the comfort of her home island to travel the ocean and save her people. And while you're getting swept along on Moana's journey, you'll want to take a minute to enjoy the scenery, which in this case is a lot of water. There's so much of it in the film. Shallow water, stormy water, water that splashes and crests in waves. There's even a water high five, water that has emotion. And it all looks and moves just like the real stuff. It is amazing, which any animator will tell you it's no easy feat to do. So how did the Disney team do it? Research, computer algorithms, a healthy grasp of fluid dynamics? How about imagination? That is the Walt Disney way, of course. Joining me to discuss the animation science behind the new film Moana are my guests, Amy Smead, head of animation, and Marlon West, head of effects animation at Walt Disney Animation Studios. Amy and Marlon, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having us.
Thrilled to be here. Thank you.
I just want to remind our listeners that we won't be taking your calls today, but you can comment on Twitter at SciFry or at ScienceFriday.com. What's the difference between your two jobs, Amy and Marlon? What do you do and what do you do?
So I'm a character animator, and we're responsible for doing all of the characters, whether it's a human, an animal, or in Moana's case, the performance part of the water.
And the effects are, as you could imagine, all the water in other movies, snow, rain, fire, lava in this film. So generally, most of the stuff that moves, it's not the character.
Mm-hmm. But the water in this film really is a character, isn't it, Amy?
It is. And in this case, it was a huge collaboration between our two departments. When the water was a character, we had a very rough rig, and it was similar to almost like a sock puppet. And we would animate the water, and then we would work with the effects animators, and they would make it actually look like water with the bubbles and the water effects part of it.
Yeah, we would do a simulation of water, you know, over top of the animated character of the water. And also, like, if you can imagine, like, a Ziploc bag full of water, and if you shook it, it would have bubbles inside it. So we would add that as well. And then it was very important to kind of stitch it back into the rest of the ocean so it didn't look like a water creature that lived in the ocean. It was very important that it felt like the ocean itself.
Yeah, Marlon, his partner Dale, and then Hiram was my partner. The four of us met very early on, and we kept talking about, we really want to make sure this doesn't look like a sea creature. We really want it to look like water and not like this other being.
Yeah, because it really does look like real water. What did you know when you started this movie that it was going to change the way you animated water?
Yeah, we knew that we had two big challenges on the film, that we had to do hundreds of natural water shots of shorelines, like you mentioned in the introduction, and storms at sea and any number of things, boat wakes, a lot of things that just had to be in the background at a scale that we've never done it before. But then we have the ocean itself as a character that was a very, very close collaboration between our two departments. And to try to make it look like natural water but still hold the character performance and the very important silhouette shapes that our animators, character animators, work towards, and not have it look too agitated. Like the things that we thought would make it look like natural water very often made the character feel maybe too aggressive or too wet. Well, not too wet, but too, you know, too agitated. So we very often had to modulate how much we were actually adding natural water qualities to the character.
Did you have to take into account the physics of water, even the salt versus the fresh kind of water?
Yeah, we have a lot of water solvers that are either off the shelf, but we created one for this show called Splash. So the kind of physics of water are pretty, understood by, people a lot smarter than myself. So, but what we actually always thrive for here in the studio, both in character animation and effects, is something that's not necessarily realistic but believable. Mm-hmm. So, our water in this film is on a level that, looks like water and behaves how people think it behaves, but it's not photorealistic.
Mm-hmm. What you mentioned this term water solver. How does that work? What is that?
So in effects, there's a lot of simulations that we do, and a solver, millions of, in this case, very often billions of particles being created to simulate water in a natural way. But then our challenge is to get the performance that we're looking for, to make it look exciting, to make it look beautiful. And in the case of our water, or the ocean as a character, it's to make it, emotive. Mm-hmm. So that takes a lot of kind of fighting against physics very often.
Amy, how much research did your team do just on water and how it moves? Did you actually go out and study a lot of it?
I think Marlon's team did more studying of water than we did. For us, we really wanted to character the water. And for the performance of the water, there's times when if you move the water up very slowly, that means something very different than if it rises very quickly. So we were more in the characterizing the water, where I think the physics side of it was more on Marlon's side. We do tons of research for all of our films, so there's tons of research everywhere within the film, not just the water. But, yeah. I think that was more Marlon's side.
Yeah, very often, part of just the very beginning of the filmmaking process here, our directors, production designers, story department, they'll do a deep dive into whatever subject, take trips, research trips. And then we also have folks come in to the studio and, lecture us about certain subjects. They'll bring animals in if it's necessary on certain films. But we did do a lot of our own kind of studies, swimming pools, or we went to Mission Bay down in Long Beach to measure how much, light travels underwater and under certain conditions so we could get it right. And a lot of these times, they're cross-department collaborations. It's character animation and effects, but it's also our lighting department, our look department, especially when it comes to the shorelines that we had to get right. We have water going up and making the sand wet, and then the sand dries as the water pulls back. And all these things that are kind of happening in the background, no one goes like, boy, those shorelines really look amazing. but if they didn't, operate correctly, they would look cheesy, even to a lap baby.
You know, I was paying special attention to the character's hair, because I remember we did a show specially about Tangled when Tangled was created and how the physics of all that animation happened. And I saw you, Amy, with in the movie that her hair gets wet a lot. Everybody's hair gets wet, and it looked very realistic. Did you spend a lot of time on that?
We did. We had, and one of the other things, we really wanted to have Moana be able to interact with her hair. And that's something that's very, very difficult to do in CG. And we had a program that was created called Quicksilver. Brian Whited and Marianne Simmons, they worked a lot on that. And Marianne had also worked a lot on the Tangled hair. So it was kind of pushing beyond what we did on Tangled. And if Moana was interacting with the hair, then we could pose the hair, and then we could send that to our technical animation department. And the tech anim department, they're the ones that are responsible for doing the hair and the cloth. So we pass it down to them, and then they would kind of make it work with the, you know, with the breeze and depending on, or if it's wet. With Moana's, the coils in her hair, they developed a ton of technology to figure that, how they bounce off each other. And there's so many strands in each of those coils.
Do you create one hair and then reproduce the hairs, or does each hair have a physics of its own, how it's going to interact?
I don't know the exact answer to that. I know they spent a lot of time in the look in our simulation mm-hmm. departments with all of those coils, and we had the ability in animation to do just a tiny coil, or we could take a broader area of the hair. So I think it was all individually created.
Yeah, it's generally like grouped in regions.
Yeah, you know, there also was a unique aspect of the film is that you had the bodies of many of them were tattooed, and the tattoos themselves were animated, which I thought was an amazing little
yes.
device that you used, Amy.
Yeah. With this being a Ron and John film, too, and they come from traditional, it was something that was so fun for us to figure out. But yes, it's a hand-drawn tattoo that we mapped onto Maui's CG body. And the fun thing for us is we had so many animators coming to say, can I please work on a Minnie Maui scene? Because it was the Minnie Maui character was led by Eric Goldberg. Eric was responsible for the genie in Aladdin, and he's an idol to all of us animators. So we had so many animators wanting to work and collaborate with Eric on those scenes. And they would, before they would start the scene, the two of them would get together and they would talk about what's going to happen in the scene. For instance, there's a scene where CG Maui pecks Mini Maui. So they figured out, Eric drew a little X of where the CG Maui would poke him. And they figured all that out. They collaborated a ton. And then that's what you ended up seeing on the big screen. So it was really fun for those, our two groups to collaborate really closely together.
How many people actually, for each one of those scenes, and let's talk about the scene with the hair and the water, how many people actually mm-hmm. sort of touch each one of different people or touch one of those things?
Yeah.
There's probably any particular scene, without exaggerating, would say a couple dozen between the story artist who storyboards it, mm-hmm. our production designers doing costume design, mm-hmm. Character animators. Tech anim, effects, lighting, rigging. It's such a collaborative process to do a CG film, and every performance and every kind of challenge takes cross-department collaboration.
You can see, because in some of these films, the credits take almost as long as the movie to scroll.
There's a lot of people that
there's
work
a lot of people
films,
that, to make them happen.
How do you animate a scene in which the water is doing so many different things at once, Marlon?
Well, very often, we'd have scenes where, there's natural water in the background, and then you have the performance, the character animation performance, and you have to stitch that back in. One of the things we did to try to remind the viewer that this is actually the ocean and this is performance, that after the big beat of whatever performance, whether it's a high five or a head nod, we would stop using the character animation and then just let the physics of the natural physics of water take over, and then the ocean would just fall back into place. And that was really kind of an important little thing we did, because they would animate the performance, completely throughout the scene. But we would decide the important part of the performance, the storytelling part, and then let the simulation take over again and let those droplets of water just fall back into the ocean. because we all kind of agreed that the ocean would not have to duck its head back down or pull its, you know, its arm back into the ocean. So, you know, those are the kind of discussions and arguments grown-ups have in our building. Like, at what point does the ocean become a simulation again?
Amy, was it more or less difficult to animate Taka, the female lava monster there?
Oh, yeah, that was...
Yeah. She was an awesome character. I loved, there were some tests done very early on, and that was another example of where we were working really, really closely with effects, with the lava coming down. We're always trying to get an emotion and a feeling through our characters. And so we needed to make sure with the lava it wasn't going to distract from that. But, and she's huge. She has a very large scale. So we had to try to figure that out as well. If she moves too quick, it doesn't look like she has weight to her. That it doesn't look like she has the scale. And if she moves too slowly, then it's not a real threat to Moana. So we did some tests. And then as animators came on to the film and started animating her, they were doing amazing things. And I love the way that she turned out.
We detail geeks like the fact that you had a little dark crust on her as she cooled off on the skin.
Oh, yeah. We try to have, like, truth in material as much as we can, even though our films are fantasies. So it was great that Taka, when she was angry, was dripping lava, like, you know, like a volcano really, you know, is. When it's really active, it's the most fiery. And that when she cooled, she would cool off when she calmed down. So that was actually a very cool thing to be able to have the real characteristics of lava or a volcano kind of match up with the character performances.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Amy Smead, head of animation at Walt Disney Animation Studios, and Marlon West, head of effects animation at Walt Disney Animation Studios. Where do you draw the line for realism? I mean, is it a concern that things become too creepy looking, like Uncanny Valley sort of thing?
Indeed.
Yeah, definitely. That's something for us. We have a lot of animators. Before we are starting our scenes, there are some animators that will thumbnail out their ideas. Other animators will go, we have a reference room, and they'll film themselves acting their scene. Even when that happens, we're not copying that performance frame by frame because we don't want the characters to look like us. And we're always caricaturing those performances. So we're pushing the timing. We're pushing the poses. We're always looking for the silhouettes of the character. There's certain principles of animation that we're always looking at. And I agree. I think if it starts looking too realistic, it can start looking a little creepy. So we do spend a lot of time figuring out just caricaturing those performances.
Mm-hmm. And how much do you count on our brain filling in what you're trying to animate? You know, because our brains do that. Mm-hmm. They fill in stuff that's not really there sometimes. You count on that, or?
It's funny because you would think you could count on that. But, you know, like we talked about earlier, the amount of people who look at all of these shots over and over and over again. So every shot of the film, Amy and I and myself and generally everybody who worked on it, the directors, I mean, they've seen each of these shots, without exaggeration, dozens of times. So people tend to point out every little thing that's not right. And we fix them as best we can. So there's very little that we're like, no one's looking over there.
Or that's
not really important because you should be looking at the character, Moana's eyes, because that may work if you watch these shots like three times, but we watch them dozens of times, and eventually someone's going to notice, like, there's a pop over there, or that tree that wasn't there in the last shot, or there's not footprints back there, or something. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we don't count on folks filling in gaps as much as you would think we should.
Yeah, we're very detail oriented.
Yeah, you would have it, and it really shows. You know, beauty is in the details, and really does show in the movie. And if you want to see some clips of what the water animation looked like at different stages of filming, we have those on our website. They're really cool. Go to sciencefriday.com/Moana. We're going to take a break. We're talking this hour about animation science in the new Disney film Moana with Amy Smead, head of animation, and Marlon West, head of effects animation at Walt Disney Animation Studios. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about animation science in the new Disney film Moana. Amy Smead, head of animation, and Marlon West, head of effects animation at Walt Disney Animation Studios, are joining us. Are you working on anything, you know, for virtual reality? I was sitting there watching the film. It was just gorgeous. And I'm saying, wouldn't it be something if I'm watching this and I could turn my head around and see all that ocean and all the people around me? Is that something that you guys are thinking about?
That would be really cool, but I don't know. I haven't been in any conversations where we've been talking about that. There might be some people in technology that are talking about that.
There are folks in the studio that are very, very interested in VR. And, you know, we did do like a VR test for Zootopia and like on one of the street scenes. We did not do one for Moana. It would have been cool.
Yeah.
But I have to say, one of the things about water is so kind of difficult and expensive to do. To do it in 360 would be quite daunting indeed.
You need to double your budget. Let's talk a bit about the cutting edge of animation technology, for example. Let me begin by asking you, could you have made this movie the same way, let's say, 5 years ago? Was the technology available to you?
That's a good question. I think we would have found a way to make the movie, because we're always presented with challenges on each film, and we find a way to make it happen. Whether it would have been at this level, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, because I have to say, Amy and I, we work very close with our software engineers and our technology department. I'm not so sure that our directors and our heads of story are that dialed in or care one iota about what we can actually physically do. They're preoccupied with coming up with the best story ever that they can, and we scramble and make it happen. So I think we would have maybe been developing water instead of snow 5 years ago if we wanted to make this movie then.
What do you mean? What was the toughest part that you needed the new technology to do? Was it the water, making it look the way it did?
I think the scale of it. You know, both. I've been here since the 2D days, so I started off on Lion King, and you know, water is always kind of tough for animation to do, either both drawing and creating CG, because it's very complicated. It changes its physics. You know, a splash comes up in a big sheet. It turns into beads and then into droplets, and they go back and make other little events on the surface of the water as it goes back in. And everybody knows that that's happening, and they take it for granted. So we usually have a couple dozen water scenes in a movie, and we had hundreds of them. So it was a big... It was a big challenge to be able to do the scale of the water, even, like I said, water that you're taking for granted, even just the wakes behind water. We had to do them on a scale that we've never done before. So that was a huge challenge, one that we started working on like 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, once we know what type of film we're making, and the directors in the story department, our technology teams start way before figuring out all the technology, whether it's water or lava or whatever that is.
Yep. Like, you know, I worked on Frozen as well, and there wasn't really truly believable snow solvers for deep snow. You know, there was always little kind of footprints and things in animated films before, but people walking around in waist-deep snow, people hadn't done. And our early tests showed that they weren't very convincing. So, like, our films always have some type of creative desire to drives a technical challenge and solution.
So if it takes years in development, there must be films that are in development now that we don't know about. I'm sure you're not going to tell us either.
There are a lot.
So is there new technology you would like to see? You're going to say to the technologists, hey, we need to be able to do this in the next movie. Get us new technology to do that. You know, where is that cutting edge? What if I gave you a blank check? I'll give you the blank check question we give on Science Friday. If you could, if you needed to develop a new technology to do something in the animated world, what would you like to? What would you love to have?
Oh gosh!
Wow.
That's a good question.
I mean, would it be 3D? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, would it be a 4D or something? You know, we talked about virtual reality. Not sure what that would
be. That would be really cool.
Is it a question of just money then, of investing in virtual reality?
It's money and computing power, because there's no limit to the imagination of people in this building, both the technicians and storytellers. But you can only just push so many pixels, you know, being computed, so many particles and characters. So we do run into the problem of just being able to render the images of our films in a timely fashion at the level that we like to do it. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think for us in character animation, there are times when there are just efficiency things where I just want to ram my hands into the computer and move the character around, but I can't. I have my mouse where I'm moving that around and really cool technology-wise.
Yeah.
That would be really great.
Yeah. You want Minority Report capabilities is what you want to move.
Yes. Yeah, because we are, you know, we are making very complicated imagery and very emotionally kind of hopefully effective images. And, yeah, we are using a mouse or a stylus to draw or a keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
And so they aren't the tools that man and sisterkind have been using for tens of thousands of years to create things. You know, people have been getting their fingers wet with things more often.
And there's 24 frames per second. So with every 1 second, that's 24 drawings or 24 poses. For us on CG films, they're really poses that we're creating in the computer. But there's 24 just for 1 second. So it kind of gives you an idea of that it's a time-consuming. It's really fun, but it is a time-consuming process. We'll animate a scene it's probably 3 or 4 seconds in a week.
Hmm. Well, I have one final question, because I know our listeners are going to be interested in this. If they are interested, if they're in college or school or whatever, and they're interested in working in animation, how do you get into the job? What should they study? How should they get into the business?
For me, in character animation, I went to an art school in Chicago, and I took tons of life drawing and painting classes. Even though we're creating films today that are computer generated, I still think drawing is very, very important. And for us, we are also studying a lot of acting and performance, because we're breathing life into these characters. So I think you still, even though we're in our desks, nobody sees us acting, we spend a ton of our time really acting and figuring out what the performance is of those characters. And then also body mechanics and physics, how your body moves across the room, whether you're bending down to pick something up or opening a door. We have to have a really good understanding of what's happening when you're taking footsteps. You know, your hips are shifting over to one foot so you don't fall over. Just having an understanding of the physics in your body, I think, is super important. And then for us at Disney Animation, what we look for is a reel that has animation tests. And we like to see acting performance tests where it's a character with dialogue, as well as some tests that are showing some sort of physicality.
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Amy said, and for effects, you know, we actually are creating natural phenomenon quite a bit. But when we look at a reel, we're also looking to see if someone can actually caricature that stuff a little bit more. Because, you know, like I said, you know, the computer wants to do a very realistic simulation, and that's fine. And a lot of people, once they learn these packages, they can do that. But our effects have to be sad. They have to get laughs. They have to look scary. Mm-hmm. And so if you could caricature fire and smoke and dust in a way to support storytelling and production design, that's what we're looking for.
Yeah. I got what I needed, what I was looking for. A great interview. Thank you both for taking time to be with me today. Amy Smead, head of animation, and Marlon West, head of effects animation at Walt Disney Animation Studios, talking about a really terrific animated film, Moana. Have a great weekend. Have a happy holiday to you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Oh, yeah. It was wonderful to be here.
Some of the best movies ever made go hand in hand with some of the best film scores ever composed. Think The Godfather or Star Wars. The music complements the drama playing out on the screen. It heightens our emotions. It connects us with its characters. But science films, well, they can be a little trickier. Abstract concepts, dry storylines, no lead characters. For example, what music would you use to describe geologic change? What does genetic adaptability sound like? Well, if you can't imagine it, just ask my next guest. Darren Fung is a film composer, most recently for the three-part science series, The Great Human Odyssey, which aired on PBS this past October. Darren, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
Darren, you were tapped to score this documentary, even though you say you weren't really a science nerd in school. So why did you take this project on?
To be perfectly honest, when Niobe first approached me to score the film, I was kind of going like, I don't really get it. When I first started, understanding the sort of the story of how humans were able to adapt and how they were able to persevere through all these difficult adversities, I think it makes for an incredible story. You know, all the big emotions that you're looking for, there's adversity, there's mystery, all these sort of things. And that's what makes a great, great film score. And you tie that in together with science. I mean, I've learned so much about evolution in the process of doing the score. It's just really fascinating material. Mm.
Is scoring science any more difficult than scoring other kind of films?
I think that when you score science, you have to figure out a way how to tie those sort of abstract ideas, the ideas that don't necessarily have the emotional core to you, and figure out how to translate that into emotion. And I wouldn't say it's more difficult than other film scores, but I think that you have, it's a little bit of more of a stretch to draw that line. And a lot of that, depends on the director and how his interpretation of it. As a film composer, you are always at the service of the film and to the director. And that, that director's vision is always, key into how you take that musical interpretation.
I guess you're trying to find some sort of emotional background behind the science, whether, as you say, it's evolution or any kind of emotion behind that.
Absolutely. And, to give you an idea, when we're looking at some of the more investigative sort of things, taking a look at, how did we survive through the Ice Age? How did we, let's look at how did art come to be? How did we move from Africa into Europe? Those sort of things. And you take a look at what those emotions are. A lot of it's mystery. A lot of it is, there's grandeur to a lot of the stuff. Some of it is incredibly magical. Those are the emotions that you latch on to. And that's where, as a film composer, that's the kind of thing that you go like, wow, I can really spread my wings and show what I can do with that.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Darren Fung, film composer, most recently for the three-part science series, The Great Human Odyssey, which aired on PBS this past October. All right, let's have you talk us through some examples for some clips.
So the first clip that I want to talk about is it's a cue that's called Change is Constant. And this cue sort of deals with the instability of the environment being a big driver of human evolution. Changes in the environment were, they were constant, they were fast, they were extreme, and they were dangerous. The Earth went from wet to dry and back to wet again. How did humans survive all of this? And how did we avoid extinction? It's our ability to adapt. And as an example, we talk about humans' ability to use ostrich eggs, to carry and store water. So how do we score this adaptability? I don't really think you score adaptability, but again, it's that emotion. Mm-hmm. You score the danger, the apocalyptic nature of these extreme, environmental changes. And then you move into something a little more inquisitive when you talk about innovation and adaptability, something a little bit more quieter, something a little bit more pensive. And then finally, you return to something bigger when we see, something almost angelic and miraculous when we talk about the ingenuity and the resilience that, help us realize, yes, wow, ostrich eggs. Wow, we can hold and store water, which is really quite amazing.
Okay, let's hear some of that clip.
Thank you.
That was beautiful. Did you find that the choral music, the choral part, was important to bringing that emotion?
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that Niobe, my director and anthropologist filmmaker friend, he was actually pushing really hard to add choir. Part of it is that, you know, we are talking about humans and there's that little, you know, human voices. But I think that the choir adds such an added level of emotion that, you know, the natural voices just elevate it, you know, to where an orchestra, you know, is obviously fantastic. But again, choirs just reach out to you and just grab you and give you goosebumps.
Yeah, it does. Let's talk about another clip that you brought with you.
So this clip here is called The Dawn of Symbolic Thought, and we're in Africa, and we're looking at symbols on cave walls here a little bit. And then what we do, that we travel to Blombos Cave in South Africa looking at an archaeological excavation, and, you know, the possibilities of what humans can record. As we travel to Blombos, we realize, you know, the scientific significance behind what is there. You know, it's often been called the cradle of the human mind, and so the music has to play homage to the significance of Blombos and what, you know, why we build and we climax in the music there.
Okay, let's hear it. It certainly has a dramatic buildup at the end.
Absolutely. You know, and again, it's, you know, we're going into an archaeological dig. It's not, you know, if you're kind of looking from a typical Hollywood perspective, it's not perhaps the most exciting thing, but you have to realize that, you know, this place is huge. You know, Blombos, yeah. It's again, the cradle of the human mind. And, you know, it's my job to kind of help the viewers realize the significance of all of these things.
You're also working on scoring a virtual reality project right now. What extra things do you need to take into account when you do VR?
So right now I'm working on a little project called, well, the working project is called Dogs Wearing Rubber Suits. And it's it's a little bit of a joke because it's about sea lions, and we're kind of looking at this incredible image of sea lions just swimming around, being playful, and just kind of, you know, exploring their environment there. One of the things that when you work in a non-two-dimensional environment is that actual spatial perception really heightens that emotion a little bit more. I remember the first time I worked, not so much in VR, but in 3D, and then, you know, going to the actual screening of a film and seeing smoke and fog. You know, smoke and fog in 2D is one thing, but when you go into 3D, then it heightens that emotion a little bit more. So you have to have a little bit of an imagination to be able to say, wow, okay, you know, I see this on a flat screen, but what is it, like, how am I really perceiving this? And I think that you have to step up your game a little bit in a sense that you have to bring that emotion to match that level that you see in a multisensory world.
Well, looking forward to seeing that one, too. This is really interesting learning. I learned a lot about film scoring today. Darren Fung, film composer, most recently for the three-part science series The Great Human Odyssey, which aired on PBS this past October. Thank you for taking time to be with us, Darren.
Thanks so much for having me, Ira.
Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, too, as well.